Chapter 6. Aboard the König Wilhelm. Despair was a foreign emotion to Thomas. His French-born father had lived by a devil-may-care attitude that suited his shady business dealings and carousing, while his Irish mother faced life's struggles with a Catholic fatalism that imagined the worst possible outcomes in even the sunniest situations. His parents' personalities blended in him in a form of frequent bouts of melancholy, which he dealt with by diving headlong into adventure of any kind, from high-stakes gambling to short-lived romantic encounters. But the sense of hopelessness and depression that was enveloping him now, as he huddled for warmth in the dark pinnace, was something he had never experienced. And he knew he had to shake it off before it overwhelmed him and prevented him from doing whatever it took to get out of this mess. He leaned back against the side of the boat and concentrated on what he must do right now. For starters, he needed to relieve himself. Then he would need food, more water, and most of all, he had to find out where the hell the König Wilhelm's next goodwill tour port of call would be. Vladivostok, Russia, was one possibility. The main Russian naval base for the Pacific had just been moved there, following the end of the Franco-Persian War and the unification of the German states into a single political entity a year earlier. It made sense that Germany would want to cement better ties with Alexander II. Thomas struggled to do the calculations in his head. Would it take 2 weeks to reach the Russian coast? Three? How could he survive during a voyage of that length? And even if he did, how would he get off the ship? And how would he explain his status to the Russian customs officials when he presented himself with no papers, no luggage, and no money? Another possibility was that the König Wilhelm was heading south, along the coast to Mexico and South America, past Tierra del Fuego and around Cape Horn, and into the Atlantic Ocean for the journey back to Europe. Thomas had heard stories about the ferocious weather around the Cape, but the seasons were reversed below the equator, and South America would be in the middle of the summer season. A southerly voyage might not be so bad. What if they were headed to Japan or even China? He slammed his fist against the side of the boat in frustration and willed himself to stop speculating. He had to face the fact that there were an endless number of possible destinations for the German warship. He had to act now. It was approaching 4:30 a.m., and the early watch would soon be waking the ship's 700 sailors and 36 officers to have breakfast and set about their morning duties. For the second time in 30 minutes, Thomas put on his damp clothing. Then he popped his head out from under the canvas tarp and peered up and down the length of the deck. The air was still, and the glow of the mast lamps cast pale yellow shadows of the funnels across the teak decking, but no sailors were in sight. He clambered out of the pinnace and went swiftly over to the railing to relieve himself into the ocean. As he turned to climb back into the small boat, he caught the unmistakable aroma of fresh-baked bread, followed by voices and the sound of footsteps coming up the stairs from below decks. He ducked behind a stack of wooden crates and waited. A moment later, two forms appeared out of the darkness and walked right past him. Each of the young sailors was carrying a baking rack loaded with several dozen loaves of bread. They set the rack down on the long bench close by the main mast and then hurried back down the stairs to fetch more bread to cool in the morning air. As soon as the bakers disappeared, Thomas dashed over to the racks and scooped up four loaves. Then he returned to the pinnace, shoved the bread under the tarp, and climbed back in. The smell of warm bread filled the boat and cheered his spirits. He tore right in, marveling at the flavor and the quality of the ingredients the ship's bakers used. By the time he finished a full loaf, the boat had come to life around him. Sailors were chattering as they passed the pinnace on the way to their duty stations, and he heard crates being moved and the clanging of metal against the masts. It sounded as if they might be getting ready to unfurl some of the ship's 28,000 square feet of sail to supplement the power from the steam engine. Then, two sailors came to a halt next to the pinnace and began talking in animated voices. Thomas's father had taught him French, and he knew a bit of Latin. but he could only make out a few of the German words. He sorted out a few of the more colorful terms for women's anatomy, including die Munchi and der Arsch, but heard no mention of any geographical location that might hint at the ship's destination. A moment later, one of the sailors laughed at a joke his friend had made, and they moved on. Thomas settled back in the boat and willed himself to come up with a plan. First, he knew he could not abide remaining in the dark boat for more than one more day. He was going to have to find a hold or storage room where he could hide until late night, when he would stealthily roam the boat in search of food and information about their destination. Once he knew where they were going, he could formulate a real plan, but not until then. He made a pillow with two of the wool peacoats, and as the great warship steamed steadily somewhere, the gentle dipping and rising of the 368-foot ironclad plowing through the waves helped him to fall asleep. Dappling sunlight filtered through the sailcloth canvas covering the pinnace at midday, and he woke with a hopeful attitude. There was enough light to go through both storage benches again, where he found a German Bible and first aid supplies, including a bottle of opium-laced laudanum, surgical scissors, and scalpels. Then he noticed there was a third storage compartment built into the bow of the little boat. Inside were two bottles wrapped in burlap, a ceramic chamber pot with a lid, and a box of candles and matches. One of the bottles contained pear brandy. The other was filled with corn, a grain spirit fermented from a mash of wheat, rye, buckwheat, barley, or oats that he had been introduced to by a German-born cook in the 109th. He uncorked the brandy, tore off a piece of bread, and celebrated his good fortune. A few minutes later, he was fast asleep. He woke to the sound of the ship's bell ringing the start of the midnight to 4 a.m. watch. He stretched to loosen his aching muscles and was pleased to note that his clothing was finally dry. He slipped on his boots, buttoned his coat, and poked his head out from under the tarp. The sails were furled, and the ship's twin funnels were exhaling a deep stream of cotton ball clouds that glowed blue and silver under the light of the full moon before wisping away into the night. No one was on deck, and he took a moment to marvel at the stars glittering in the velvet dome of the sky. That was when he spotted the planet Mars, almost directly over the main mast. The star Vega was above the horizon and to his left, and he could make out the distinct glow of Jupiter just off the starboard beam. Also clearly visible were January's brightest constellations, Orion, Canis Major and Minor, and Gemini. Thomas had studied the heavens since he was a child on the farm in Ohio. Given the warship's position relative to Mars, Vega, and Jupiter, there was no doubt about their heading. The König Wilhelm was steaming to the southwest. That eliminated Russia as a possible destination, and Japan and China as well. The most likely possibility now would be Australia, which was over 7,000 miles and 3 weeks from San Francisco Bay. He ducked back into the pinnace and packed a cotton bag with bread, brandy and corn, and the candles and matches. Then he put the laudanum and the surgical scissors in his coat pocket, climbed down out of the boat, and crouched behind a water barrel. Despite his bleak circumstances, he was feeling better about his prospects. He would find a way to survive the voyage and get past the Australian authorities. It was an English-speaking nation, after all, and if he could make his way to a military base, there would certainly be officers who knew the history of the American Civil War who would be familiar with his name and story. He was sure they would help him find a way to return to America. The honor of the worldwide fraternity of professional military men would demand no less. Walt Whitman had told him that his fame, undeserved and unwanted as it might have been, would open doors for him for the rest of his life. As he swung the bag over his shoulder and stole quietly along the rail towards the bow of the ship to find an entrance to the front hold, he couldn't help but smile at the irony.